Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to the fourth newly recorded episode of Free Forum from 2017. And I'm going to be joined today by activist and organizer, although he might quibble with the word activist. We'll talk about that. Activist and organizer Jonathan Smucker. He's got his first book out, Hegemony How-To, Roadmap for Radicals, and I highly recommend it. After hosting and producing the show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews in 2014. Since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere, on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. Following the election of Donald Trump, however, I cannot resist exploring the path forward in confronting him and his administration. On Free Forum, we've always explored the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. So first off today, I want to offer you, as I've done each of the new shows in 2017, offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in the resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And you can email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com if you want to get these websites and more information. IndivisibleGuide.com, OurRevolution.com, that's the what became of the Sanders campaign, CourageCampaign.org, which is primarily a California organization, but a very, very strong one, and they have specifically what they call now the Courageous Resistance, with meetups and actions and so on. MoveOn.org, which has sort of changed its method a little bit. MoveOn had always been, if not solely, certainly primarily an online phenomenon, and they have realized that it's got to be linked more clearly to action on the ground. So MoveOn.org. Here's one, FiveCalls.org. And FiveCalls will actually, you go on there and it'll give you a call or five calls to make every day, and it's set up very to make that very easy for you to do. The TownHallProject.com, which is to find when your congressional representatives are going to be holding town halls in your district, and how to get yourself to them and become part of the constituency that they have to respond to. Jonathan Smucker, the co-founder and director of Beyond the Choir, has worked for more than two decades in grassroots movements for social, economic, and ecological justice as an organizer, campaigner, and strategist. He also researches the same terrain in his doctoral work in sociology at UC Berkeley. His writing has appeared in The Nation, Alternet, Yes Magazine, among others. And his first book, as I said, is Hegemony, How-To, Roadmap for Radicals. Welcome, Jonathan Smucker, to Free Forum.
Hey, thanks, Terrence. Thanks for having me.
Okay. My first question, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So, and I think in your case, this is really an important strand. Can you tell us briefly about your path to the work you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. When I myself talk about story and narrative, I say a story has a beginning, middle, and end, and a narrative has a past, present, and future. So this, in some sense, is the narrative of your work.
Yeah, well, you know how it is. It's different every time you tell it. But I come from a my path is I think probably statistically a bit of a unlikely path. I was raised conservative, rural working class, very religious in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, outside of a little town called Bird in Hand. Growing up, my family life revolved around church several times a week. I grew up Mennonite. I went to Mennonite school. And wasn't all that interested in school, wasn't very academically inclined. In high school, a couple things happened at once. One thing was that I started to encounter racism and homophobia at my high school. And a lot of the perpetrators of it were people that I had been very close friends with back in like junior high, other folks from Lancaster County who were targeting people who then I became friends with in high school. And you know, that had a big effect on me. And I think part of what was politicizing about it, because I really didn't have a political vocabulary. I probably would have seen things like racism as a matter of individual attitudes. And on that level, at that point in my life, you know, being 15, 16, and seeing the way the administration at the school handled it, kind of turning a blind eye to some of the perpetrators, and making it seem as if the problem was the people being targeted.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, had a very big politicizing effect on me. And I didn't know how to raise my voice effectively at that point, but some of my friends and I did start raising our voices, started going down to the office and talking to administrators. And that had a big effect on me. At the same time, I actually started reading the Bible for myself for the first time. I grew up going to Mennonite school, and we had to memorize verses every week as part of our schooling. But reading it for myself, I suddenly saw all this stuff about social justice and economic justice and, you know, these verses like, "Woe to you who are rich." And I had never been taught any of that stuff, and it felt very disillusioning. It felt like big theme, central theme, I would say, in the Bible was left out. And I didn't think it was like a grand conspiracy. It just seemed to me that people were gravitating away from verses that they might have found more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of set me on a path where I wanted to figure out, well, if there's such a problem with the accumulation of wealth, and there's such a, and that's related to poverty, what's that about? Why does that matter in Scripture? Because I was very religious at that point in my life, and I started reading things. I had some teachers and other folks who turned me on to Mennonite Central Committee in Lancaster County has an alternative resources library. I started reading publications like New Internationalist and Multinational Monitor and the Catholic Workers newspaper and other things like this, and basically started educating myself about the global economy, about economic justice issues, and then things started getting very interesting. I gave a chapel at my high school.
That's right. Tell us about that chapel where what it was, every morning there was some sort of chapel moment, and you said, can I lead one day?
Yeah, well, you have to sign up in advance, and in fact, there's an administrator who's in charge of it who kind of was privy to my emerging radicalism, and I had tried to get a chapel several times, and they always found a way of dodging it. But then I took the speech class in my beginning of my senior year of high school, where that was one of the projects you could do for credit. You had to do some public speaking. And so I had my official way of getting
mm-hmm.
a chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And we had chapel every morning at the beginning of school for about 15, 20 minutes, like a mini worship service.
Mm-hmm. I went to Catholic school, and of course we had a similar thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
what happened that day?
I signed up for one. I was terrified of it because I felt called to say some things. And about half of my script, I wrote it out because I knew if I wasn't reading it, I would probably back away from some of the harder things.
Uh-huh.
I was a very accommodating at that point in my life. I was very afraid of conflict. And so I was very anxious, very nervous. About half of it was scripture, and about half of it was applying it to the global economy, and through a global justice lens. At that point, I think a lot of people, like I had been, were very sheltered from some of those issues and that kind of perspective. It was very challenging.
What year was that, Jonathan?
That would have been 1995, the fall of 1995.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of people walked out, led by the student council president was the first one to walk out. And I got a lot of flack for that. I got even some threats and a little bit of violence, actually, nothing too major. But I kind of expected that because coming from the Christian tradition, I was like, and the Mennonite tradition, the Anabaptists, it's like we have this book of all the people who have been martyred and
right.
tortured for taking righteous stands. So to me, it was kind of like once I decided that this was an issue I had to stand up for and I had to do all this work to get myself ready for it. It was kind of like the story that I knew was of the righteous person taking a righteous stand, and that story in the Christian tradition ended on a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of expected people to reject it. What I didn't really anticipate was how many people would be supportive and interested in hearing more and doing something about it. And so that was a really important turning point for me. And I ended up working with somebody at Mennonite Central Committee to Dave Schrockshank to launch this campaign at my high school my senior year called World of Enough, where we educated ourselves about the global economy. And it really made me realize that there are more allies out there than what you think, and that just because there's a dominant narrative doesn't mean everybody you see subscribes to that dominant narrative. I think it's easy for us to kind of look around and not see outward, overt signs that people care about social justice values.
Well, I think one of the things I thought you said in the book was that the people that agreed with you hadn't necessarily done anything to let you know they agreed with you. In other words, it's easy to sort of go along, and that once you said, hey, you put it out there, then it gave them the opportunity to go, oh, I kind of think that too, right? That there is,
exactly.
there are silent majorities all over the place. They aren't just right wing. They are yeah. most people.
That's right. And I think more and more that's the case. You know, I think in my context, we probably were not a majority back then, but a substantial number of people cared about these things. And depending how you framed it, there would be a majority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on some things, there's absolutely a majority that would say they cared about social justice and economic justice. And that's exactly right. It's that people don't necessarily have the structure or the opportunity to manifest those beliefs or to feel safe that they can voice them or even have the vocabulary to put it in a certain way. And
right,
so
right.
For it to even
occur to them that this would be something that one would want to talk about or do anything about.
Yep.
One thing I want to say is this instance, it seems to me, has really, in some sense, you could go back and you could find resonance in that incident in everything you've done since, that you have an organization called Beyond the Choir. You didn't just say, we want to reach out to the people who maybe aren't active yet, but even put it in sort of religious or church terms, the choir. I mean, it's to me, it's fascinating how if I were to point out what's different about what I found in your book and your way of looking at things from a lot of people, it very much has to do with, to some extent, what you're doing is you're saying there are more people like who I used to be than we know.
Yep.
And I think that's what gives you the power of it, is it's that basically young Jonathan is available out there to be stirred and inspired.
Yeah, that's right. And like I said, my onboarding was my kind of finding this path was somewhat unlikely. But we know through behavioral research and social movement research that the biggest determinant about whether people get involved in social movements is somebody providing them an opportunity. So it's proximity to opportunities. And so when the American left over the past 40 years has kind of structured itself in, you're right, I do take issue with the word activism.
I know you do.
Structured ourselves in this thing called activism, where where it's self-selectors who care about a thing and find each other. And so if we're structured in a way that people who are looking for the thing already get involved, as opposed to kind of taking those opportunities and presenting them to people in a way that feels accessible and feels like something familiar, like something that's not a huge break from their everyday life, but something they could do as a member of a church or a synagogue or as part of a worker at their workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we weave those opportunities, kind of weave politics back into the fabric of society itself? And that's some of why, yes, that's some of why I started Beyond the Choir, was taking that head on and looking at both how do we do that, and also what's preventing us from doing so? What is making some of our organizations have this very strong tendency to talk to ourselves, this tendency toward insularity?
Mm-hmm. And let me even say that we have to move fairly quickly here because we've got I want to cover a lot. But your thing on activism, just to emphasize it again, is that what you suggest, and I hadn't seen many other people say it, is that the very self-selected group of activists, once there is an activist group, then there's everyone else who isn't. And,
right.
And so even if what the activist is proposing or what the activist is inviting someone to participate in or inviting them to think about is actually speaks to this other person, they're either less likely to hear it or less likely to act on it because they go, oh, but that's for activists.
That's right. Even if they don't have a negative view toward activism, but we actually know through research now that a majority of Americans do have a negative reaction to the word activism. But even those who don't, unless they themselves think of themselves as an activism, it's still best case scenario is it lets them off the hook. It's like, oh, you're an activist? Have fun at your protest on Saturday.
Go
I'm
get them.
I'm going to hit the holes. Yeah, you do you, I'll do me. And whereas when we talk about civics or we talk about politics, that infers a commons and a common responsibility, as opposed to activism, which kind of has this framework of a hobby or a self-selecting kind of extracurricular activity that some people do and others don't.
Right, right. Let's move ahead a little bit, Jonathan. Share just a bit about your experience organizing against the Iraq War with Lancaster Coalition for Peace and Justice in Lancaster County. And again, so now we're in 2003. So fill in, just before you begin to answer this question, a little bit of what you did then. You dropped out of high school and got involved in serious organizing before you end up in the Lancaster Coalition for Peace and Justice. What did you do in those intervening years?
Yeah, I did finish high school. I flunked out of high school, but I did finish with a very low GPA. My mother pulling me by the ear across the finish line.
Oh, okay.
Bless her. But you're right. I didn't have any GPA that was going to get me into college anytime soon, and I had no interest in college. I dove into social movements, and I became disillusioned about this tendency toward insularity.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of really submerged myself in some subcultures.
Catholic Worker.
And the Catholic Worker, and then Earth First, and some more like anarchist circles during the global justice movement.
The Global Justice Movement, just to remind people, that would be 99. That's Seattle
99. 99 to like 2001.
Yep.
Basically, Seattle 99 kicks it off.
Yep.
Protests against the World Trade Organization. And September 11th, 2001 kind of closes this window at roughly.
Yeah.
And it was a popular moment, but there was still this tendency toward insularity that I felt happening. And I started thinking, do I move back home? Do I move back to Lancaster and organize there? Because we really need to be engaging these areas that have so long been abandoned by any kind of scaled progressive organizing effort. You know, labor is kind of the last vehicle that was doing that, and still does some places and pockets, but not in the scaled way that organized labor used to. You know, like thinking about Pennsylvania, the areas between the two ends of, you know, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, these areas have been neglected by any kind of a progressive organizing project. And incidentally, you know, that's Trump really filled that void. That's part of what happened this year.
Exactly.
We'll get back to that. But so I moved here, and it was during the lead up to the Iraq War. And the Iraq War, I think, really presented this moment where a lot of people just felt so upset about the direction of the country and alienated. And so even in a conservative area like Lancaster, by calling a meeting to talk, a town hall meeting, to discuss the war and take action, we were able to draw out 200 people, and then we were able to build that into a vehicle that lasted for about 10 years called the Lancaster Coalition for Peace and Justice, which I eventually directed. And we had, it was mostly a volunteer. I was the only staff. There was a coordinator before me for a couple of years, and then I took that position. There was only one paid position. And it was mostly a volunteer-driven effort that was structured into working groups, people. And part of what I was figuring out at that time, along with the people I was working with, was that if we could get people into long-term roles, you know, sets of tasks that they felt ownership over and that they could set some limits on, you know, something like 2 hours a week, maybe 4 hours a week, but that it wasn't going to take over their whole lives, those people would last. Those people would keep going because we kind of burnt through a wave of people at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
People would drop everything and they'd be so passionate, and then they'd start getting pushback in their lives from their loved ones,
sure,
from other commitments, and those folks would drop off. So we started thinking about this, about how do we get people into longer term roles. It's interesting. So we've used that model now for what's just emerged since the election, and has actually, in a very short time period, surpassed any level of organization we ever had with the Lancaster Coalition for Peace and Justice. We've got about 2,000 people on our list now. We've turned out 2,000 people for an event, which is bigger than anything we've ever had in decades in Lancaster. That was in the aftermath of the wake of Trump's first Muslim ban attempt. So we've been using the same model, and we're now grappling with plugging people into roles, starting working groups.
Let me cut in for a second, Jonathan. Yeah. A question that I was going to ask towards the end of the interview, but I'm going to throw it in right now, is that when I talk to folks, and I assume you've had the same experience once you talk to folks outside of Lancaster, that one of the largest challenges for progressive organizations right now is the outpouring of volunteers that have come forward since the election. And they, okay, maybe they marched on the 21st. Maybe they've marched one time since. But you have more people wanting to be involved right now due to the Trump presidency than you have the capacity in the past to deal with or the need. I'll give you a specific. Liz Winstead is a friend of mine. She was one of the creators of The Daily Show. And now her life is really dedicated to an organization called Lady Parts Justice. Travels around the country, does comedy shows, and raises awareness, money, support for Planned Parenthood, etc., all over the country. She told me that her normal, in a year, she might get 50 people who want to volunteer. Since the election, she's gotten 650. There's no way She has the capacity to give, to engage them and make this meaningful. If I were going to ask you, what would you suggest on a big basis, not just in Lancaster, but if you had advice for organizations or for the movement, in quotes, what, how do we best not fumble this?
Yep. That is the big question. And that is mostly what I'm doing right now with my work with the national organizations that I work with, because all the big organizations are struggling with this. And let me say a bit more about the problem. Part of the problem here is that we have gotten used to what we were just talking about a few minutes ago, the self-selectors doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
The small radical volunteer groups that are used to not growing, and the professional staff, more liberal groups, some radical groups, but that are used to, you know, staff-driven operations. And so, you know, Theta Scotch poll talked about this. Robert Putnam has talked about this. This kind of decline of civic participation, the atrophy of, like, the muscles of democracy, and the reliance on staffed organizations. So suddenly, in terms of the willingness and the excitement for regular people, everyday folks, to get involved in the political process, that changed so dramatically on November 9th. It is impossible to overstate how dramatic that shift is. In a smaller city like Lancaster here, I couldn't leave my house for at least 2 weeks without running into people who would stop me on the street, who've never been involved in anything before, saying, how can I get involved? Tell me what to do. Somebody said, I will work half time. I'll take 20 hours instead of 40 and survive on it if you tell me what to do with my time. I need something to do right now. And so people were begging to get involved, you know, showing up for racial justice chapters all over the country. You know, I heard in Hudson, they usually had a dozen or two folks, 400 people came to their meeting. People were taking whatever on-ramp they could get. And the problem is we're just not structured as organizations for this. And so this was exactly our theory with Lancaster Stands Up of, we have to build a structure that can actually onboard the energy that exists here, the people who are coming out of the woodwork, who are begging for a job. And, you know, I don't think we've done that perfectly, but I actually think we've done it better than maybe anywhere I've heard in terms of this kind of local volunteer effort.
So let me sort of rephrase my question just slightly, which is, I think one of the things that your whole book deals with is that as long as you proceed under the old model of a small staff, paid staff, and a few self-selected volunteers, you can have an organization that works, but it's unlikely to scale to the extent that it can win. And so what we've got is the possibility now of scaling something quickly, or we will lose them. So how do you translate, if you will, what you've done in Lancaster to a larger model?
Well, we're working on that. We're working on scaling it statewide and nationwide. I think what I would say is a few of the lessons
Great.
That are important for anybody who wants to try this at home. So we believed that protest and election volunteering, activity in elections and protest in a city like Lancaster, a medium-sized city and a surrounding county, is actually unfamiliar terrain to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that we needed we need to build an opposition that has a protest face and that has an electoral face, because we need an electoral game in the coming years.
Mm-hmm.
But we thought that in the meantime, we also need a civic face.
Mm-hmm.
So we planned emergency community meetings, town halls. We used spaces that people are familiar with meeting here, and we called it emergency community meetings. We're very careful in our rhetoric. We don't talk about activism. We don't talk about protests. We use plain spoken language. And we give all the signals that this is a place where other people in the community are coming together to talk about how we're feeling about the direction of the country and to figure out what we can do together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put Lancaster in the name. Lancaster stands up. We didn't take an existing organization and try to expand our chapters here. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing that. There's nothing like and organizations have done that. I know that the NAACP has grown here since the election. Democratic Socialists of America have grown. There's nothing wrong with trying to grow your organization. The problem is when we think that just growing these specific mission-oriented organizations is going to create the broader participatory opposition face that we need right now. And so we've created an oppositional space, Lancaster Stands Up, that can onboard at scale new unaffiliated volunteers and can also relate to existing organizations in the community. And I think the big psychological change shift that a lot of folks have to do, one, because we're used to professional staffs or tight organizations, we're used to controlling everything
yep.
that we do. We're used to, you know, being in charge. And if that's what we're doing right now, we're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If you can control the alignment right now that you're helping to kick off, then it's not big enough, right? So we need to be unleashing social forces that we can't even control. We need to be embracing an unwieldiness to this moment, because that kind of unleashing, you know, the kind, you know, like the airports is a good example.
Yep.
We've got some good examples of this happening. The Indivisible Guide, that has really helped a lot of people who, you know, want to get started on something, to have a way to experiment and get going. And, you know, it's tricky because I think it's been uneven in terms of whether those efforts take off. You know, like the emergency community meeting that we kicked off here, some organizations like Working Families Party and Move On, we worked with to do that type of thing all over. It's been uneven in terms of whether those groups have taken off or whether it was kind of a flash in the pan. And some of what we have in Lancaster is some skills. People, the two biggest things, I think, are people knowing how to facilitate meetings effectively and people knowing how to do outreach and create buzz to generate interest in an event. Those are kind of basic skills, but they are actually skills
yeah.
that matter, that often operate behind the scenes. And I think we're in a process of people relearning those skills. And so what I encourage some of these national organizations to do is to reorient their mission so that their staff organizers, they can play a role. But instead of seeing this as a moment just to build their own campaigns, what about cutting loose some of that staff time to help build some of these more grassroots operations, to help train people to be good facilitators or to do door-to-door effectively or to do good outreach? Because there is an important role for people with skills and for staff members. It's just we have to be really orienting ourselves to this political moment and the broader opposition movement.
Right. And let me ask you a couple of more specific questions in this realm here. When you are saying an opposition movement, do you use that language in Lancaster? Do you claim that what you're doing is creating an opposition, or is it more positive than that?
You know, we do. We do say that we're in an opposition. I think Trump weighs very heavily on people. We actually mention him surprisingly little.
I bet.
He's in the water.
Yep.
He informs everything. We don't have to.
Yep.
So, but we also do exactly what you just said. We frame this in terms of values. And in fact, we frame everything in terms of Lancaster values. At our rallies, we say Lancaster values. Like most of the signs you'll see will start with Lancaster values. Lancaster values healthcare for all. Lancaster values welcoming refugees in our community.
Uh-huh.
Lancaster values immigrants in our community.
So let me just say two things I hear there. One is you start off with we, because when you say Lancaster, in Lancaster, what you're saying is we. Right. And that we can be as inclusive as anyone who sees that sign makes it. Right.
Yep.
And the second thing is values is something which people can do, which doesn't sound like a fight. It sort of has to do with morals. It sort of has to do with religion. It is an action to value something, but it's an action that's a little ambiguous what it means, but it touches on that side rather than fight, rather than legal, rather than any of those sorts of action verbs.
Yep, I think that's right. And so we don't shy away from the fight. I think it's a matter of emphasis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because people are mad, and they want to get Trump out of there, and they want to take back the House and the Senate, but they don't just want to take back the House and the Senate either. They want to change the direction of the Democratic Party. They want to change so much, right? And so people know that there's a fight, but you emphasize the values. And I think part of what you just said about the we is really important. I think there's a tendency in the left, you know, we also say America, right? We say we want an America for all of us, and we say things like that. So I think there's a tendency in the left to sometimes be like, to say, well, America was never valued immigrants. America has never been a welcoming space. America has never gotten race right. Now, analytically, that's true. and you could say the same thing about Lancaster. We could have signs that say Lancaster has always been wrong. Lancaster has this shameful history on
Lancaster's never done enough.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so we can third party Lancaster like that, or we can third party America, or we can contest the meaning of it and assert that we are Lancaster,
yes,
and that we are America,
right?
And so it's contesting these powerful words that are these larger we's that people in our community identify with. It's saying that we are Lancaster, and we're not going to let other people represent Lancaster in this way that's xenophobic, or that's, you know, cutting off healthcare for people who need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite important,
right? Or that works just for the 1% of Lancaster or that section of Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Okay, now I'm noticing, God, we've got less than half of this left. I'm going to have to talk to you more after this is over, because I've got much more I want to talk about. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't spend some time talking about your experience with Occupy, because I think it's a kind of a crucial piece in here, because it is in some ways such an example of many of the things we're talking about, or one can draw from it lessons that inform what we're talking about. So you were not one of the originators of Occupy. You got involved a month in or so?
A little less than a month, yeah.
Uh-huh.
In early October.
And just
so
say a little...
September 17th.
Okay, so, yeah, exactly. So just in means of introduction, what was your involvement? And then we'll talk about what succeeded, what didn't, and what lessons can be learned.
Yeah, well, I was very skeptical of Occupy before it started, not because I didn't want it to succeed. It was called for by Adbusters magazine. I felt like they were pretty not in touch with how to do organizing, how to make anything happen besides cultural critique. And then when it started, it my impressions from afar was that people were kind of putting their brave but countercultural foot forward first, and kind of inoculating people against them as the messenger. And so I was skeptical. I think a lot of organizers I knew were skeptical. But then, you know, something happened. People stayed with it. There was the Brooklyn Bridge mass arrest in early October.
Yep.
And suddenly it broke into the news cycle. And I think there was this moment where unions, community organizations, and then viewers on TV, like, might not have thought this was the perfect message or anything, but we were so ready for somebody.
Yeah, that's what
to
I think.
Name the culprit.
That's right. I think so much of it was that, you know, the 99%, 1% distinction had been crying out to be made, and it hadn't
That's
been.
Right. Yeah, and some of us tried it. You know, there's an organization called the Other 98%. It got it 1 point off. I was part of helping to think about that name, and so
right.
People were talking about 98% to 99%. But I guess we got it one digit.
Right. You were off by one.
And that combined with this defiant stance
yes.
at the doorstep of the culprit of the financial crisis and the larger democratic crisis, the rigging of our political system, I think it just came a point where people were like, yeah, I'm glad someone's standing up.
And by the way, I hadn't even thought of it that much then. But as we know, so often these things often start on college campuses, right? Well, the difference that this one had Wall Street in its sights and Wall Street in its name at a time when everyone said, why didn't anyone do anything about Wall Street, right? We're at
That's
that point.
Right.
Obama has let them off the hook completely. They've been bailed out. This notion that some just folks are going to go down and stand up to Wall Street, I think you're right. I think it 99% needed to be said and Wall Street needed to be confronted.
Yep. So once it became clear to me that
something was happening,
starting to catch fire,
yeah,
then I was like, okay, this is actually important, and I'm gonna lend a hand. I'm gonna do what I can to help it keep building its momentum.
And you got involved in public relations.
I decided to come down for a couple days to help out.
Oh yeah.
I ended up in New York for a year.
Yeah.
Miraculously, my relationship survived. But I have a very, very patient wife now who is also a social justice organizer. But I went down to help out for a few days to plug in where I could. I helped with some trainings, and then I really got. It turned out that the public relations working group needed some structuring, some support, and I ended up plugging into that in a pretty hardcore way for about 6 weeks as a primary thing. I was involved in the movement building working group as well. I was involved in helping with what became Occupy Homes, which was a campaign across the country. I actually spent a lot of time with Occupy Homes then in the following year.
By the way, let me say, when I think about Occupy, I think that Occupy Homes was it makes sense to me that that's what you would get most involved in, is one of the places where it got translated from cultural, the 99% versus the 1%, to action.
Yeah, it started to land from, you know, this defiant symbol of these occupations, these parks, and even the ones across the country, they were symbolically connected to defying Wall Street, right,
uh-huh,
because
uh-huh.
of the name. But Occupy Homes really suddenly became something that we could throw down on an issue that really mattered to a lot of Americans, people who were underwater in their mortgage or who were facing foreclosures because of the housing crisis when these banks got this bailout, and none of that translated into relief for struggling homeowners. So I worked on that quite a bit. And then I was part of informal conversations all the time. I say this in my book, but I think that the General Assemblies were more theatrical than functional. A lot of the real decision-making was happening in informal kind of underground things. I was in my 30s. I'd kind of been through this rodeo before. I'd been part of anarchist subcultures where people say they don't have leaders and but really leadership is happening. So I was very critical of that model. Was definitely part of these things that were happening all the time behind the scenes. Most of the things happening behind the scenes was just working
exactly.
all the time.
Well, because for people who don't know, and there are probably some who don't, what Occupy did once they put a stake in the ground and said, we're here, whether it was at LA City Hall or Zuccotti Park or any of the places around the country, was then they usually had a kitchen and they had a library and they had classes and they attempted to actually create a community in that site, and that takes work.
Yeah, it does. And then there's also campaigns, there's mobilizing our allies, there's behind the scenes work, a lot of a lot of folks, and even including in Occupy Wall Street, like to think that when we called for a day of action, that there was just a spontaneous outpouring of 30,000 people. Well, you know, that was getting labor unions to mobilize their people. Organizations like Working Families Party and New York Communities for Change, right? So there was work with our allies. There was keeping key city council members on board politically to push back against Mayor Bloomberg to buy us more time, to stop him from evicting us. All this stuff was happening behind the scenes. And, you know, in the PR working group, training people on message discipline, training people to talk to the media, doing interview practice.
Jonathan, from inside there, doing what you were doing, being part of it and its spinoffs for a year, what worked and what failed?
I think you named the biggest thing that worked, and that is changing the vernacular of the society. You know, a couple days before Occupy started, we were having the sequestration fight in Congress, where the debate was between this amount of austerity and that even worse amount of austerity. And that was how debates were framed for years. That trickle-down economics was common sense. There was no anytime you started saying things like, you know, maybe the very rich should pay a little bit more in taxes, you're accused of class warfare.
Yep.
There was no class-conscious popular vocabulary.
Right. Even and, just on a very specific issue, the notion of if you talked about Social Security, it was how much to cut it and when. The thought of expanding it would never have been in the conversation, and after this it was.
That's right. And so not a lot has changed politically in terms of policy and structures yet since then. That is our next step, obviously. But I think we've created the cultural foundation to organize a powerful force now to fight for those things. We actually have the premises of a different kind of unification in the society, the 99% versus the 1%, the people versus the elites.
Let me suggest one thing. I think you resonate to this somewhat. I mean, I think that the 99% 1% is in some sense a populist message. And 5 years later,
absolutely.
5 years later, one could make the case that that identification spawned both the Sanders and the Trump campaigns. But we ended up with the Trump presidency. Other than Democratic Party leadership working for the nomination of Sanders, what needed to happen for Occupy to spawn in those 5 years the change we're talking about, where those things turned from rhetoric to action?
Well, one, the Democratic Party should have nominated Sanders. It is insane to double down on an establishment candidate when you're in the midst of a crisis of legitimacy where people are angry at the establishment.
Well, I've pointed out, when you look out, you see there were two candidates drawing 20,000 people. They're going to nominate one of them. We're not.
Yep.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's like unilateral disarmament.
Yeah.
So what's incredible is the Democratic Party leadership still does not understand what it did. But back to Occupy for a second.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the 99% vocabulary that made Trump possible. I think it's the crisis of legitimacy.
Oh, I see, yes.
That made both the Tea Party and Occupy possible, and both Trump and Sanders possible.
Okay.
And so a crisis of legitimacy, you know, just basically is when governing power is seen as illegitimate by a critical mass of the population.
That's the populist moment, right?
It's the populist moment. And so what is populism? I mean, different people have different definitions. The one I would use is more from like Laclau and Mouffe. But it's who they emphasize kind of a rhetorical form, which I think is a part of it. You know, the quintessential populist move is to articulate a new premise for society, you know, to articulate the people versus the corrosive establishment.
Whatever and it is that has gotten that illegitimacy or that feeling of illegitimacy,
exactly.
You have the people and versus so, that.
Right. And so in a crisis of legitimacy, you have both poles kind of bolstered. and vying, you know, outsiders vying to rearticulate the premises for having a society and the premises for the political alignment of forces it's going to take to change things. And so we're in a very, very dangerous position right now because Trump won that electoral contest, even though right-wing populism is extreme. The actual policy positions are incredibly unpopular, but we should not underestimate the possibility of Trump consolidating a long-term right-wing populist alignment. We're in a very, very dangerous, vulnerable position right now. And the lesson is not to forfeit populism. The lesson is to have a progressive populism. And what do I mean by progressive populism? I don't mean not to talk about all the other issues that are important to us. It's 2017. We're going to talk about race, and we're going to talk about Trump's xenophobia and misogyny, right? We've got to talk about that. We've got to talk about the particular struggles and issues of all the people that need to be in our alignment, but we absolutely have to do that alongside, you know, where Bernie is a good example is his willingness and Occupy, willingness to name culprits and to pick open fights with Wall Street and the 1%. As long as the Democrats are not willing to do that, they will forfeit the populist mantle to Trump, and he can consolidate that popularity, and that could be devastating for decades.
So if I were to take what you just said, one of our tasks, in addition to mobilizing and engaging all of these volunteers into greater civic engagement on the local level, the state level, to have them come to the polls in 2018, et cetera, at the same time, it's to do what needs to be done, if you will, behind the scenes, to get past the Democratic inability to go against some of their primary funders.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that's not behind the scenes. I think it's counterintuitive because we do need a broad, united front to fight Trump, but we have to pick an open fight with the current Democratic Party leadership over the direction of the party. Because if we don't, if they go into 2018 with the same unwillingness to throw down against entrenched economic power that they've had for the past few decades, if they show that they're not actually going to fight for working people, then they're not going to be very powerful against Trump. They're going to be feeble.
That's right.
They have an opportunity
absolutely
to actually show that they're willing to fight for working people and to actually consolidate a long-term governing majority that's popular, to get a whole new generation of young people excited about politics and willing to work with the Democratic Party. So they've shown since the election, they're not going to just do that on their own.
No.
We actually have to run primary candidates. We have to pick open. Primaries are the only language these people are going to hear.
That's right. Just as the Tea Party did to the Republicans.
Exactly. And the big difference, I would say, with us and the Tea Party is that the Tea Party actually has extreme positions that aren't popular.
That's right.
You look at progressive positions, taxing the wealthy,
yep.
You know, progressive taxation, health care for all, drug legalization, changing the mass incarceration system.
Making college affordable.
You know, yeah. Gay marriage, marrying anyone marrying who they please. Right. All these things. These are popular positions. So Democrats thinking, oh, we can't be too liberal, they don't understand
I know.
That society is not orienting itself along these old liberal conservative stale frameworks. They're orienting themselves around populist establishment frameworks. And if you don't come out boldly to get ahead of that, you're just forfeiting the opportunity.
And basically, we can't afford that to happen.
Let me ask
you one more big question, and then we'll wrap up. I attended a conference last year and again this year called FRANK. It's about social impact communications. And last year I led a breakout, which I said, and I know this is stuff that will, you know, make sense to you. Change the story, change the world. How are we doing? Now, a year later, the story's gotten worse. And we have to use this crisis as an opportunity. We need people to take seriously the threat we face and the different, better future we say we want. So this year, I introduced the session with this quote from Antoine Saint-Exupéry. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea.
Mm.
You get where I'm going. My question, how do we do that in 2017? What is the compelling narrative that will drive Americans to yearn for a future richer than the past some of them want to go back to? And what vision can we offer to engage their emotions that will fuel their yearning rather than feed their fear?
Yep. I love that quote. I've used that quote before, and it's funny. I love it, and I also pick at it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, because we hate the fact that it's drum up the men. And
right. Part of what we have to do, actually, is also teach people to build ships.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
The actual mechanics, because I think right now people do yearn. Well, they yearn for that. People are fired up, and they're concerned, right? And so we have to absolutely tell a vision that's not just putting a close to the nightmare that is
right,
Donald Trump.
Right.
We can't be shy about we're not going to get there on a America is already great narrative, right? And we're definitely not going to get there if what we do is we just bond with each other over how backward half the country is for the next 4 years. That would make the next 4 years the next 8 years,
yep.
Right? So we have to tell a vision about an America that works for all of us,
yep.
Right? A vision about expanding those three aspirational words, we the people, to actually include everyone, right? To include people regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their sexual orientation or their country of origin. We have to tell a story that both, I think, centers. We have to come to terms with the scourge of racism in this country, and in an aspirational way, we have to understand that until we look at that and we figure it out, we won't be able to have the unity that we need to take on the big moneyed interests that have divided us from each other over our identities. While they've consolidated power, while they've literally, their lobbyists have written the legislation
sure.
every session
sure.
for decades, right? So we can tell a story that is about us coming back into our, like busting back into politics, you know, to reclaim our democracy. And I do think we need that. I think we need that story. I think...
I get your point that also we do need to know how to gather wood and build, that's a lot of your book in the second half goes into some of the things, and that's why we spent some time on very specific things. How do you actually make this stuff work? Make it work on a day-to-day basis. We've got to pull this to a close. I've really enjoyed this, and I will be in touch with you off air, believe me, Jonathan. So again, the websites are HegemonyHowTo.org. We didn't even have the conversation about why that title, but we'll leave that for another time. HegemonyHowTo.org and BeyondTheChoir.org. The book is Hegemony How To, Roadmap for Radicals. Any other things you want to do to tell listeners where they could learn more? Other websites, Facebook pages, anything?
You'll find it all there. My own personal writing is at JonathanSmucker.org. But,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you, Jonathan Smucker. Keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay. Stay on the line for a sec. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-N-N. T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, T-E-McNally@Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely and keep up your good work.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear on the Leslie Marshall Show weekdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network. Well, the Congressional Budget Office said yesterday that next year, 14 million fewer Americans will have insurance if the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's known, is repealed and replaced on the terms that the president is seeking. That tally would rise to 21 million in 2020, and by 2026, 24 million Americans will not have insurance. And for what? To give a gigantic tax cut to wealthy Americans. Now, according to the CBO, the loss of health care coverage under the Republican plan stems largely from gutting Medicaid for low-income Americans, even though Mr. Trump has said he would not cut Medicaid. Coverage would also be lost in part because insurance would become unaffordable for millions of subsidies are withdrawn. Hear the whole story on the Leslie Marshall Show, Monday to Friday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific, on the Progressive Voices Network.